Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, we conclude a two-week conversation with John Fulcher, plus The Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. For ArtSound FM Community Radio, I'm Peter Searles. Since the publication of his first collection in 1983, Light Pressure, Canberra-based poet John Fulcher has gone on to issue many other volumes and to be a regular contributor to prominent journals. A 2010 Australia Council residency took John Fulcher to Paris. In 2012, Pitt Street Poetry published his The Sunset Assumption, which drew from his time in France. Pitt Street then published his 101 Poems, 2015, A Casual Penance, 2017, and Dancing with Stephen Hawking, 2021. His next book, The Night Stare, is due out in April 2025. Robert Gray aptly wrote of John Fulcher's poetry, "His theme is a skeptical faith, complemented by the uneasiness of domesticity. It is the heroism of the modern, isolated individual, the man or woman who remembers to put out the garbage bin for 50 years, who stands on the nature strip and looks at the unbelievably violent furnaces that are the stars, and asks what place there is for the transcendent impulses that arise within us." When we left off last week, John Fulcher was sharing some thoughts about how religious poetry can be effective when it explores questions and problematic when it asserts beliefs. This week, he begins by considering the nature of poetic inspiration and of his poetry.
Do you know Les Murray's poem, Poetry and Religion? It's a very esoteric, intellectual poem, but it suggests the connection between those two things, but it's not an easy connection.
Would you read your poem for him?
Yeah. This is an actual conversation I had with Les Murray, by the way. Conversation with Les Murray. "They say you're a genius, Les. It was fact and idle flattery." "Genius? It's adjective, see? Not noun. See, Peter? He has genius hands. Jeff there's a genius teacher. With me, it's poetry. Though genius has a simpleton twin, always behind the same eyes." "Which convinced me of only your genius."
It's a little thing, but what I love about this poem is that the listener can't see it, but it's so short, 7 lines.
Yeah.
Each line just gets a hair longer than the one before.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
We've got to unpack this just a little bit more, even though it's so tight anyway.
Yeah. It's like, let me expand on this for you.
That was something that I wanted to say, too, about the title poem, Dancing with Stephen Hawking. There is humor in your poetry.
Yes.
It's very subtle.
I hope it's like a wry smile or a raising of the eyebrows. Sometimes I try to do it much more bluntly, but that's what it is. After my first book was published, I remember a friend of mine said to me, "Look, I really like it." He said, "But where are you?" He said, "When I talk to you and when we go out and have a drink," he said, "you're witty, you're funny, you're full of, you know, wicked humour." And he said, "And I can't find that anywhere in the book." He said, "The book is sensitive, you know," and it really stayed with me. And then I thought, at the same time too, I remember I got a review of the book by a wonderful poet who's since died a long time ago, Gary Catalano, who sort of liked aspects of it, but you could tell he was sitting there going, And I'll never forget his final sentence. His final sentence was, "I feel that John Fulcher is writing the poems that he thinks he should be written rather than the poems that he has within him. When he turns to the latter, his work will greatly improve." And I remember it cut to the deep when I read it first of all. But the older I've got, the more I've thought, that was very, very true. It's a case of saying you've got to find those poems. Who gives a shit about the poems that have to be written? You know, someone else will write them.
Right, that's right.
Yeah. You write the poems that you have, whether people like them or not.
I don't know when it occurred to me, but at some point in my life, midway, it occurred to me that when somebody talked about my poetry and it cut deeply, it meant they were right.
Yes, exactly.
And I just had to start wrestling with that and let my poetry get better.
Yeah, I think so. Les Murray said to me once, though, he said, that can get out of control. He said, you get, you know, 20 reviews for a book, 19 of them are glowing, one of them's not, and you think, I didn't fool that person. And I think you've got to be careful of that too. Mm. But I do think every time you feel that knife cut, you think, yep, they're right.
Yeah.
And I've got to take that on board.
Yeah.
The aim of a good review is not to flatter you. It's to help you.
Yeah.
You know, and to help the reader, I think.
This is shifting gears just a little bit, but I've really been looking forward to talking about this. When I was reading the introduction in your 101 poems, you were talking a little bit about how the publishers asked you to publish the poems as is.
Yeah.
Without updating them or... And then there's a poem in the back of your most recent book, Revising Casuarinas, for Robert Gray, where you begin with that same thought, right? You take it up again.
Yep.
And so I thought, this one's 2015, 2016, so we've got almost a decade here.
Yeah.
Where are you standing on this idea?
I stand very firmly on the idea that there must be a point where you let a poem go and you are interfering with the integrity of the poem if you try and make it better after that.
Hmm.
I didn't always feel that way. I got a selected poems published, I think, in 2007 or 8. And I made a mistake there with one of my mentors and most loved poets and good friends, Robert Gray. I said, will you help me look over the poems and make them better? And he is a notorious reviser all the time. And he went through every poem, said, change this, change this, change this. And in awe of him, as I was then, because he's a wonderful poet, I did it all. And the poems, when I saw them published, I thought, well, they're better, but they're bloodless. And they're also, there's something disingenuous about them, because I say this is from 1983, but it's not. This is the experience of a younger man who wasn't probably as proficient in what he was doing as he is now.
Mm.
And to pretend otherwise is a lie. And I feel really strongly that there has to be a point when you let a poem go and say, no, that's it. And I think that point is the publication in a book. If it's in a magazine or something, it still gives you time before it's bedded down in a book.
As always, I think the value is in the discussion. Right.
Yes,
I mean, preparing for this, I knew I was going to ask this question. So I've been thinking about this from every angle in terms of like Walt Whitman, right?
Yeah.
Who never, ever stopped revising Leaves of Grass. That's the one extreme, right? So at one point, do you just let it go? And almost like a child.
Yes, right? That's right.
You let him be an adult.
Yeah, exactly.
Let him be a grown up.
And I'd say the same about Whitman. I don't think he did himself any favour by constantly revising this.
Mm.
He might have made them better, but they lost their freshness.
Mm.
You know, sort of. And when I did the 101 poems, John Knight, my publisher, was adamant. You publish them exactly as they were. And there was only one change I made. I talked about a cousin of mine as mongoloid, and I changed it to Down syndrome, as I should have.
Mm.
But that's the only change that I made in the entire book. And I there were times where I thought, oh, I really want to change that, you know. But I thought, no, you either stick by this principle or you don't. And so let it go out there into the world with all its flaws. Because the good thing when you put together a selected poems like that is what you're also saying to the reader is, look how I have changed. You can see how I have got more proficient, hopefully, and you can see my development. These are not just poems. I think the poet and the poem are integrally entangled together. You will see one, you know, that they belong with each other. You know, does that make sense?
Completely. Yeah. I mean, I think in some ways that goes back to what you said earlier in the conversation about how hard it is to get any distance from your own work.
Yeah.
And that is why it's that entanglement.
Yep.
You're invested and it's very hard to get a distance on it to think, okay, how good is this really?
How many times do you think you've written a masterpiece and you think, oh man, the Nobel Prize should be arriving soon? And then you get it out a week later and you think, oh my God, this is shit. You know, sort of, it happens all the time, doesn't it?
Do you have a new poem or two that you could read?
I do. This is one of my favourites. And it brings together all those things I was saying about seeing, about religion. And it's quite, I think it's really dense and you can get lost. But I like it. I'll read it. Portals. You take each other's hand, look up at the portal. The rose window blooms above a clutter of stale saints and kings whose stone heads tumbled in the revolution, symbols of God's rot, his coziness with suffering. The cathedral thins to a spike lodged in the sky's side, the chimera clinging to its vertical perch. Inside now, you think of a nave of grass and raised earth, a line of lichened pillars, the vanished rites of dissolution ruins, where the roof is a sweep of clouds and windows are portals for the frost to preach its rules to the absent monks. Then you're back, wading this river of faithless disciples who worship only altitude, the impossible, unearthly height of Gothic assumptions. They eddy past the pews to the holy place of exit, its trinkets, souvenirs, medallions, postcards. You turn now, think of a Reformation sanctuary, its dark, unsinging choir ruled into latitudes, seats in a ritual before the day asks for payment, seats at sunrise for the few in love with silence, undying autumn. Sit now for evensong, in a chapel of shadows, lamps at the crossing like tiny moons, portals of pre-Raphaelite faith, an ashen Christ holding his lantern like a tiny sun, coming through darkness in Arian splendour. Now you're drifting under molten blue light in a different ambulatory, that Madonna holding her upstretched finger like a spire, the baby in her arms composite, human. And now you're here, in this southern place where gods diminish. You're standing at the altar in a pastel Baptist box, her body draped in the routine chic of her bridal dress, the pastor standing like a waiter at table. And now this littler church, souled unblessed, that you prize into a house, still like a church with every painted wall, every kitchen bench, every bedroom wrestle. Here, still, all things echo that bucolic covenant, sepia parishioners at the portal, eucalypts brushing the rusted iron roof like spidery angels. You think of an elder past, a time before creeds. You think of suns, the mist of galaxies, banks of an unending dark, an end to things. And you think once more of the altar, how it was then, how you settled that ring to her finger, a small portal to the body's trance. You remember the wedding walk, among family and friends, how everything was a blessing. You think of every beginning, of the portal's release. You go out into the bright day.
You live in a refurbished church.
I do. Yes. That's right. Yeah.
And I don't know why. That just kept coming back to me.
Great. That's as you're, good.
In some ways, the portals are.
Yeah. It's an old church out near Braidwood. And it's funny. You've got to be careful saying things like this, but it doesn't feel like we own it. It feels like, almost in an indigenous sense, we look after it. We're caretakers.
John Fulcher said he has written some poems that touch on the suffering of people close to him, and then has wondered what to do with the work, whether to publish it.
This is one of the most recent poems I've written, and a friend of mine in midway through last year, took his own life, and he did it in a car. And I, amidst all the grief and the shock and, you know, the questioning of oneself and this sort of thing, all I could think of was, what did they do with the car? And so this is called Shifting the Car. The body gone, he takes the rubber hose from the slit of open window on the rear seat driver's side and coils it in the boot. Slips now into the driver's seat, brings it back to upright. In the stale air, he thinks he can smell an odourless gas. He winds the windows down, settles at the wheel. Then, trespassing for a moment, he fumbles in the glove box. A standard manual, a logbook clocking maintenance, This shopping list, a receipt from Bunnings, some mints, a note from a daughter. Above, the trees are riddled with birds. Wind spills through the leaves, across the empty road. He turns the engine over, nudges the accelerator, and just like that, hits 80. On the highway, the motor sounds like a sigh. Fidgeting with the radio, he stumbles across a playlist of easy listening, thinks of whiskey in a lifted glass, wishes he had a car like this. But now he comes to the compound and his constable salary sedan. As if docking a spacecraft, he steers this thing from another world into its given slot, turns the engine off, sits there in silence, feels in the leather the form of another man. That's a poem. As I say, it's one of the most recent poems I've written. So putting it in the book, it's probably the last poem that was written chronologically in the book. It's one that I feel really anxious about because I feel like I haven't given it time to actually, for me to know just what it's like. So I was trying it out on you there in lots of ways.
It's about perspectives, right? Imagining what, you know, what was happening to your friend.
Yeah.
But then the everydayness, what's in the glove box.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting, life goes on, right? You have to do something with the car.
Yeah.
How do we manage it all?
Yeah.
And I think that poem really looks at that question from so many angles.
Oh. Yeah. Some poems are hard to write.
Yeah. Many times those poems are hard to hear, but they'll have, I mean, that's a poem, I won't forget it.
Yeah, that's what you hope, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, you know Robert Lowell, who wrote Life Studies and things, for Robert Lowell, the most important thing was the poem, and the experience of those around him, be it his ex-wives, his parents, his grandparents, was secondary to the poem. It was awe which he could mine for the poem. And he used to do things like when he was splitting up from Elizabeth Hardwick, she would write him angry letters, which he would then parse and turn into poems and publish them. And I once heard an interview with Lowell's biographer, Ian Hamilton, and the last question they asked him was it worth it? In your opinion, was it worth it? And he paused for a moment and then he went, no. And I think that there've got to be times where you say, no, I want to write that poem, but I'm impinging on something far more important. Lowell was a big influence on me, and I've gone through a section, I think about my third book, where I mined a lot of my own relationships. And I look at it now and it's my least favourite book because I thought, no, I'm telling stories. It's not my right to tell. And I recently, you know, just to use a recent example of that, my son who lives in London was going through a really hard time and I wrote a poem about it. And I was really pleased with the poem. And then I looked at it and thought, no, it's not my story to tell. And threw it out because I thought, this is his story, not mine. You know,
Yeah, and that's about perspective too.
Yeah, it is.
Right?
Yeah.
That really is.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how then, you know, I've written dramatic monologues, right? So how do you think that the same idea of what stories we can tell and can't applies to the dramatic monologue?
Because that's a really good question.
When we get into a voice...
Yeah, I feel quite strongly about this. I think that there is a feeling amongst some sections of poetry in this country that you can only tell your stories. Mm. And I think to me that's antithetical to what poetry is. And it just sounds contradictory to what I just said, but it's not. I recently wrote a poem, I wrote it a few years ago, and it was written from a woman's point of view. You know, it was about students, girls that I used to teach, and just the ones that didn't make it. basically. And when I was writing these series of vignettes, I thought it's a bit creepy if you make the voice a male one. So I turned it into a female voice. And I thought that detaches it from me too, you know, which is another thing. And it won a big prize. And then I have to be careful about how I say this without breaking confidences, but I heard that it was considered for a major anthology, but one of the editors said, no, men have no right to write about women's experience. And I thought, these people have no idea what a dramatic monologue is all about. Jeff Page said to me, these people think that Robert Browning was a murderer. We had a terrible instance of that in Australian literature a few years ago, when a poet called Stuart Cook wrote a poem from the point of view of a bogan Australian using a Thai prostitute, and it was ugly. And there was no way that he was sympathetic to the narrator, but he was castigated and cancelled for it. And I think that the crassness of that, he still suffers from that. Mm. The crassness of it, the inability to... Do these people not understand, you know, sort of like... You know E.E. Cummings's poem, You Gotta, which is a phonetic poem written from the point of view of a racist bastard drunk in a pub in somewhere in Texas or Alabama, saying we've got to civilize, you know, sort of Asian people. That's not the terms he uses. The speaker condemns himself.
Yeah.
As is the same with My Last Duchess or Porphyria's Lover. And I think that the dramatic monologue is absolutely crucial in doing what poetry does best, which is putting ourselves in someone else's shoes. Now, we may not get it right, but it's certainly worth the attempt.
Yes.
Yeah. That was a bit of a rant.
That's okay.
In a case like the one you just outlined, where a poet speaks in a voice that is objectionable to
yep.
whoever, the mistake that those readers make, it seems to me, is, as you say, ascribing that sentiment to that person. But are they actually perhaps not understanding their own discomfort with the voice that person has voiced?
Exactly. And living with it. And being able to confront it. It's really interesting that there's that also confusion, as you say, Peter, with the narrator and the poet, or the persona and the poet.
Yeah, because you have some poems like that in...
I do.
In the 101 poems where you're talking about the school settings.
Yeah, yeah. And, there's one really ugly poem about a PE teacher written from his point of view. It's an ugly poem. And I hope nobody would think that I am actually either sharing that opinion or approving of it. That's a skill, I think, to be able to let someone condemn themselves, I think. And it's a really, there's a real crassness and bluntness and a lack of sensibility in not being able to make that distinction, I think. It's really interesting, too. I don't think we should ever assume that the I in a poem is the poet. Robert Lowell said at one stage, he said, people, when they read something like Life Studies, they think they're getting the real Lowell. I made half of it up because the poem has its own life. And I think we should understand that.
That's absolutely my default, is that each poem has a life of its own.
Yes, exactly.
And the poet gives it life.
That's right.
So... It's not the same. Going way back to one of the first things you said in our conversation, too, there's the subconscious at work, too.
Absolutely.
And it's just all so complex.
Yeah.
Poetry, I think, allows the expression of complexity, or at least the depiction of it. And then what you do with it, what the reader does with it, it's up to them.
Yeah.
What Kimberly just said brings us back to that issue of whether you can effectively revise poetry. When you write the poem, it's sort of like you're almost in a spell of your own.
Yeah.
So how would you recreate that moment in the future anyway?
I think that's dead right, Peter. Les Murray, this is connected. I think Les Murray used to talk about poetry as when you write a poem, you go into a kind of trance. And I think that's right. I once did a wrote a textbook about crafting a poem, and I interviewed about 8 poets, including Judy Beveridge, Robert Gray, Rosemary Dobson, Jeff Page, you know. And I asked Les, could I interview him about his method? And he went, no. He said, you can use all of my poems you like, but I will not talk about my method. And I think I understand where he was coming from.
Mm.
This whole idea of the subconscious, or you're not sure that's conscious. Poems from my first book were actually set for study on the New South Wales High School certificate list. And one of the poems was, I'll read this one out. It's called Harry Wood. Harry Wood worked in the mines, digging his way out of poverty, finding in his 20s an empty foreman's place. Once, he told us, he fired a man for fooling with the ropes, and the union went out for weeks. He held on, though, and they sank back to the sleek coal caves, one man short, breathing again the air invisible from rock. And one time collapsing, the moment he started, the mine nearly took him. He heard them say, "Wood's gone," as shovels rattled in the earth. Now he's bought the farm, and every year before market, he herds the steers in by himself, pricks at their tubs of meat with a current-charged bar until they panic and take the long, unbroken slope creaking into the truck. Kangaroo bones, pocked with skin and maggot bubbles of flesh, edge the house and the yard. At night, he sits and talks of the mines, stares at the dark window. When he's dead, the farm will go to his grandchildren, and they won't be poor as he was, and they'll have time, he believes, for something more than survival. Now, that poem was set for study, as I say, on the high school certificate list, and it was based on a man that my mother knew after my dad died, which was very early in life. He was the one person who she had a relationship with much later in life, and he was a horrible man. And in the end, she left him. She just couldn't stand it anymore. And he was horrible because he was just ruthless. And I wrote that poem about him in a state of bitterness, I think, yeah. And I would go around to classes, you know, and give talks, you know, at various schools. And I'd say to the kids, what do I think of this man? And invariably, it had happened time after time, they'd say, oh, he's the quintessential little Aussie battler, isn't he? You really admire him for what he's done. I think, no, you know, sort of, I do not admire him. And then when this kept happening time and time again, somehow you had to look at yourself in the mirror and say, I think I do. And I didn't realise it. There was something about him that I begrudgingly admired. And that's why the poem works. If I'd written the poem I thought I was going to write, it wouldn't have worked. The poem taught me something rather than the other way around, I think.
In today's episode of Poetry on the Radio, we've completed our 2-week conversation with John Fulcher. I'm Peter Searles.
The Rhyming Bugle. On Monday, March 3, Jeff's Poetry at Smith's features Peter Rose from Melbourne and John Fulcher from Braidwood. Peter Rose, the editor of Australian Book Review since 2001 and previously a publisher at Oxford University Press, has published several books of poetry, an award-winning family memoir, and 2 novels. His latest poetry collections are Rag, Gazebo Books, 2023, and Attention, Please, Pitt Street Poetry, 2025. You'll have heard all about John Fulcher on today's episode of Poetry on the Radio. His most recent of 12 books of poetry is Dancing with Stephen Hawking, Pitt Street Poetry, 2021. On March 10, Mother Tongue Multilingual Poetry is at Smith's. Poetry in languages other than English, including a multilingual open mic. Poetry on the Radio is produced on unceded First Nations country in the studios of Art Sound FM in Canberra. Series presenters are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with Peter Monahan. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.